Hello and welcome to Pardis from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardis Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardis alum. This week, Vayechi. This week, Rabbi Howard Marcos discusses Vayechi. Rabbi Howard Marcos is a member of the Pardis faculty. And now, Rabbi Howard Marcos.
Thank you, Larry. It's been a month of excitement for the subject of our weekly Torah readings, Joseph, son of Jacob, vice-chancellor to the great pharaoh of Egypt. This morning, or this week, as we reach the final climactic days of his life and the life of his father, we are overwhelmed by the emotions and never-ending intrigue that have filled the columns of the Torah. So replete with excitement is our parasha that we may have missed one of the greatest moments in Joseph's life, related to us in an unassuming, innocuous manner, an episode to which the rabbis paid particular attention. I'm referring to the few uncomfortable moments in the lives of Joseph's brothers immediately following the death of their beloved father Jacob. Aside from the sadness and intense feeling of loss suffered by all of the brothers upon Jacob's passing, the Torah tells us that they are thrown into a panic. The thought occurs to them, what if Joseph has refrained from taking revenge on us solely out of respect for his father's feelings? With Jacob gone, nothing will prevent a now very powerful Joseph from giving his brothers exactly the retribution that they deserve. They communicate these fears to Joseph, first by messenger, then in person. They fling themselves down before him, pleading for his mercy. Joseph soothes them and tells them not to worry. Revenge, he says, is the farthest thing from his mind. Joseph's benevolent response to his brother's anxieties, as recorded in our Torah, is stunningly succinct. Al tira'u, have no fear, he says. Hatachat Elohim ani? Am I in God's place? Joseph asks. Those three final words may sound simple, but I dare say they are anything but. Those words carry with them more emotional and psychological significance than we may realize. To understand that phrase, Hatachat Elohim ani, am I in God's place, properly, we must hear it in the context of Joseph's entire life. If we understand the process through which he went in his many and full years, if we can grasp what it was that he himself came to grips with over the course of his lifetime, then this final great moment might be able to be seen in its proper perspective. The tale begins for us only 3 weeks ago in Parashat Vayeshev. There we meet Joseph the adolescent. Like many adolescents, Joseph finds himself in a world neatly divided into black and white. People either love you or they hate you. In this case, the father loves, the brothers hate. Actions of those who inhabit this black and white world seem to be rather straightforward as well, flowing out of simple, logical feelings, although paradoxically emerging from very complicated, emotional, and often illogical hearts and minds. Our Torah narrator tells us all this by describing life as Joseph must have seen it, as a series of causes and effects. Back in Genesis chapter 37, we read, V'Yisrael ahav et Yosef mikol banav, ki ven zekunim hulo, ve'asalok tonet pasim. Now Israel loved Joseph best of all of his sons, for he was the child of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of his brothers, they hated him so that they could not speak a friendly word to him. Once Joseph had a dream which he told to his brothers, and they hated him even more. This is Joseph's early world. It's quite easy to understand. Love brings gifts, hate brings enmity. Although it contains both love and hate, life is secure and familiar, and it holds little or no surprises. For Joseph, all of that simplicity that he perceived in people and in life would soon change. The ground under Joseph begins to shift at an incredibly fast pace the moment that he leaves his father's home. He quickly comes to learn that people are far from simple and that events are far from predictable. Joseph is thrust into what the rabbis term an olam hafuch, a topsy-turvy world that seems to continually reverse itself. It is here that Joseph really begins his education about human nature and about the unpredictable and often unpleasant aspects of life. First of all, people like Joseph's brothers are supposed to redeem family members from slavery whenever possible and not sell them into servitude, which they did to their despised brother. And yet for Joseph, slavery turns into success, and just as quickly, success turns into disaster. His display of morality lands a good-looking Joseph in prison, whereas if he had relented and had had relations with Potiphar's wife and been immoral, that would have preserved his success in his master's home. Even more surprising, yet consistent in this olam hafuch, prison turns out to be the shortest route to the king's court. And yet the butler, who showed gratitude to Joseph for his successful interpretation of his dream, quickly forgets his analyst at the first sign of his own success. When Joseph's hope for freedom wanes, it is then that the butler remembers, and within a few short hours, it seems, the slave in prison becomes prime minister, second in command under Pharaoh. Such is the story of Joseph's trip from the top of the world, being a spoiled favorite child, to the bottom of the heap, and back to the top again. And then, most unexpectedly, the brothers reappear. Joseph seems torn between wanting to reunite with his brothers and wanting to exact revenge. After having them thrown into prison, "See how you like it," he seems to be saying, he takes several days to consider his next step. He settles on a plan that is largely a test, with just a tinge of revenge thrown in. And in the end, he learns some unexpected things about his brothers and about himself. It was Judah who initially had suggested selling Joseph to the traveling merchants in the first place. He and his brothers seemed to care little about the fate of their hated brother, and they thought not at all about how much pain the loss of Joseph would cause their father Jacob. It is Judah who shows us that the brothers who stand before Joseph in Egypt many years later are different men. Before, no one even began to consider Jacob's feelings. Now Judah says that he could not bear to face his father without Benjamin in hand. And the man who is prepared to sell a brother, to get rid of him forever, now is prepared to sell himself into slavery forever in order to save a brother. Poor Joseph. Surely none of us envies him his thrilling life. But in the course of his roller coaster ride, he gains some understanding of people that the Torah in its narrative makes available to us as well. The mature Joseph must have recalled how the young Joseph saw the world and laughed at his naivete. How straightforward and transparent everything once seemed. But matters turn out to be nothing like that which he expected. Joseph, like so many of us, has seen that good can turn into bad, and bad into good so unpredictably. He has seen that people that he trusts can let him down, and people who have let him down in the past can turn out to come through in the end. He realizes that he never can be absolutely certain what someone else is really thinking or what they might do next. I would go so far as to say that Joseph is as much a surprised spectator at the suspenseful drama of his life as we are. Who will disappoint him and who will come through for him? This he never really knows. And then, in our Parshat Vayichi, Yaakov Avinu dies and the brothers are thrown into a tizzy. What if Joseph now decides to pay them back? They appeal to him. Hinenu lecha la'avadim. We who made you into a slave many years ago are prepared to submit ourselves to the same fate. Do with us what you will. I think that a person less wise, less mature than Joseph might have taken the brothers up on their suggestion. After all, did they deserve better than slavery? Do they really deserve to be forgiven for their crime? Perhaps Joseph should not forgive, because if he forgives his brothers, he brushes aside the wrong that they had inflicted upon him, as if to say that it no longer mattered to him. I am Joseph, whom you sold to the Egyptians. Why would Joseph say that if he was not still carrying some kind of grudge? Who among us could or would forget this kind of dastardly deed were it done to us? But instead, in response to his brother's plea, Joseph utters three words that represent the culmination of his life experience. Hatachat Elohim ani? Am I in God's place? This sentence is shorthand, representing the vast knowledge that Joseph has accumulated in his years on the earth. The troubles of life have managed to bring him to a state of humility. Joseph realizes that most all of his judgments about people, his brothers, Potiphar, Potiphar's wife, the butler, Pharaoh, they were incorrect or inaccurate at best. They were erroneous, he realized, because at any given point in his life, Joseph had access to only one piece of the jigsaw puzzle, only one part of an always complicated picture, his own. To judge properly on the basis of incomplete data in any circumstance is impossible. Only one being is capable of seeing all the parts of the puzzle at once, and that is God. Joseph finally comes to understand this. His statement, Hatachat Elohim ani, is not so much an assertion of piety as it is a declaration of surrender. Surrender of judgment in the face of the complex phenomenon that is human nature. Joseph seems to be saying, the one thing I've learned for sure about people is that I don't know very much about them. God fully understands people and why they do what they do. I, on the other hand, do not. Joseph recognizes the fallibility that is inherent in his human, imperfect way of seeing things, as well as the infallibility of the omniscient God. As far as powers of judgment go, there is a clear line between a human being and God. Joseph sees the line and refuses to cross it. He will not judge in God's stead. What does it mean to see oneself, Tachat Elohim? I think that people act as if they are in God's stead when they pass judgment on others as to who they are, what their motivations are, or what makes them tick. We place ourselves Tachat Elohim when we mistake our imperfect view of reality for a perfect one, something that the mature Joseph would not allow himself to do. Mind you, there's really nothing wrong with the simple act of judging someone. We judge others constantly, both positively and negatively. This is in compliance with a deep-seated human need as we locate ourselves in the world by measuring ourselves against others. Everyone must have his or her private opinions of people in order to function. And surely Joseph had a private opinion of his brothers. Nevertheless, we who sit on an imperfect throne of justice must come to echo the sentiments of Joseph saying, I may or may not be able to forgive. I may or may not be able to forget. I think what I think. But since I cannot possibly know with certainty what you are thinking, I cannot and will not publicly judge you or condemn you. When we mistakenly think that our partial view of reality is a complete and correct one, when we forget that our judgment is fallible, we mistake ourselves for God. We commit an act tantamount to idol worship when we forget that our limited, imperfect way of looking at things is just that, limited and imperfect, and instead believe ourselves to be omniscient. How often do we make the mistake that Joseph managed to avoid later in his life? How many times in our lives do we presume to know beyond the shadow of a doubt that someone is what someone is really about and what really lies behind their actions, only to be proven wrong and misguided? When friends tell us that their marriage is in trouble, can we really decide who is right and who is wrong based on the amount of inside knowledge that we may possess? When a destitute person approaches us on the street asking for a handout, can we really deem them unworthy, saying he or she should go and get a job, that they don't really need our help? When a person stumbles in his or her profession, can we deduce from that anything at all about the person's capabilities, their potential, or their aspirations? I dare say we might be tempted to. But when we make these kinds of judgments, scorning and condemning people, or holding them in contempt, we place ourselves, tachat Elohim, in a place of judgment that only God can justifiably occupy. Poor Joseph. How sad he would be if he would see the sons and daughters of Jacob, the children of Israel, in later generations judging others with such little compassion and such great arrogance and self-assurance. We almost insult Joseph by forgetting his example. And what an example! Joseph, who started out with delusions of grandeur, with dreams of being tachat Elohim, who came second only to Pharaoh, who was believed to be a god in the Egyptian circles. Joseph, who had all of the ancient Near East on their knees before him, begging for food during the famine. This same Joseph is able to say in the end, "No, you may all defer to me, but I defer to God." That is the image of Joseph that we can forever carry inside ourselves, so that we always can be reminded to leave the final judgment in the hands of God, where it belongs.
Thank you, Rabbi Marcos. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.